can we take this to the actual comic for a minute? Or for more than a minute, please. I want to ask, I know in speaking to you, Justin, you said that this was important, something that James wanted to put in there that referenced Fukushima, that it was important that you have it in there. So, James, even though you and I have never spoke, I know that was conveyed to me that you wanted to put that in there. I would like to ask you specifically about one panel of the comic, and I assume that it's sarcastic, but I just sort of want to speak to it. Maybe we can speak to some of the actual information behind it. But you spend the last two pages are talking about radiation from Fukushima, and then on the very last page, there's a thing that says, I could find the actual quote, but it basically says, whatever problems there were are now basically gone. Was that a parody of the official story, or is that... Oh, sorry, it says, the danger from Fukushima, what little there actually was, is largely over now.
Well, that is the official story. And it's the other, like, the least below that you don't show, you don't hear about it, usually on, like, the news or anything. It's like, what all the experts say is that there's no danger from all the radionuclides not being ingested from Fukushima because they only count radiation when it's like an initial exposure.
It's the different models that they use, right?
Yeah.
Like heating a bag of water with radiation from the outside as opposed to ingesting it, or it's somehow otherwise getting into your body and into your tissues in that form. And I think the idea there was what we seemed to be seeing a lot of was people were rushing in to say, oh, well, you don't need to freak out about this stuff. And then you started hearing about all, you know, like, it's like, oh, you absorb more radiation flying. Or, oh my God, my brain is fucked.
James, no, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I've heard those things. Yeah. Get more. When you go to your dental hygienist to listen to your drum and bass, you're actually getting more radiation from that dental visit than you're going to get from.
Except there's a completely different kind of effect that radiation that you ingest has on your all your systems compared to what you get in an X-ray, which is mainly external. And so, even riding an airplane itself, you know, you're taking on radiation, but it doesn't stay with you and keep eating away. And what does it have, a half-life of 30 years or something from this fallout? Like, that's not something that just goes away. Like, it literally keeps eating the thing. So we obviously know that that's a cover story, like, from the Space Odyssey, you know, it's like, it's not real.
Justin, you're on the West Coast. Have you noticed any, environmental, like any obvious observable environmental effects?
Personally, no. But like I've only been trying to teach myself to garden and whatnot for the last few years. So I've definitely been on the lookout, but I mean, if something mutant erupted, I'm not even sure that I would recognize it, right? So it's, I don't know. These are the sorts of things that have been rolling around in my head for the last few years. And when Fukushima happened, it was just like, wow. Like, I literally started gardening about a month before Fukushima happened. So it's just like, and that's like, everybody's being born into that situation where it's, literally, the world is just different now. And it's not, you know, Fukushima's not the first time that that's happened. And we've known about these issues since the get-go. I guess that's part of the problem for me is that there are people out there that know all of this stuff, but they're shaping the information for whatever reasons to meet a certain narrative. So James probably knows more about that end of things than I do.
There's a book that came out recently about the actual effects of Chernobyl versus what a pundit would say they were. And it it goes into quite a lot of detail with how many people have actually been contaminated, how many people have died, and it affects children most of all. It's like one of the things all the critics of it say, like the scientists that were there, the liquidators, a couple of surviving liquidators from Chernobyl, that like they weren't told what they were doing or how bad it was. They went in there and they helped, I don't know, evacuate or shut down the reactors, and they got started getting cancer a few years later.
I mean, the information's out there. The military obviously has it because of everything that happened in the South Pacific, the Marshall Islands and all of that. And just like, but for the most part, people don't pay attention to things until they become a danger. So, and radiation's not something you can really see. And I mean, even, and we're dealing with a population that's pretty much, how many generations have grown up under threat of nuclear conflagration at this point? It's just like, mm-hmm. I don't know, that just, it sets up to me, for me, people born into that world, they're dealing with a completely different world than people prior to that period would have. Right. So I don't know.
Even the, like in doing a lot of, like I was doing research for, studying the synchronicity of these events, but I did a lot of research into atomic testing. This is something that David and I have discussed a number of times in correlation to the Moon Child and all this sort of stuff. But it amazed me when I found out how many atomic bombs were detonated as tests throughout the years. It's just a stunning number, and it's something that I think there was a brief point in time where it was environmentalists would speak about it, and now that the tests aren't done anymore, and now that, you know, people like to say there's no more threat of atomic war, which I don't buy, but that radiation is still in the environment from all those hundreds and hundreds of tests that they did. And then there's the idea, like you said, you know, the idea that of atomic war. When I think it was 2001 when the remake to Planet of the Apes was made, I was so offended that Tim Burton, he's talked about changing the ending of Planet of the Apes, and he said, well, that's because I don't think, he's like, you know, the first Planet of the Apes was made in a time where people were worried about atomic war. I don't think that's an issue anymore. Like, what the fuck you mean it's not an issue anymore?
Right. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's not an issue on people's minds, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, every time, like, the Secretary of State says all options on the table, that's a code for the nuclear option.
Right.
And, like, some country's not playing along.
Yeah.
It's like a armed, if you go to a store with a gun, if you don't shoot anyone, you're still committing armed robbery. That's what the nuclear blackmail story is about.
I think it's like an example of like when there's enough charge on something, one is paradoxically more able to like overlook it, which is really odd, but it's the nature of repression, right? So like even like when dealing with something like birth trauma, it's like something so distant that's so much closer than we're normally able to recognize because it plays into like everything. And so I think there's like an inevitability that radiation has to do with, like, man-made structures don't endure long term. That's just a fact. And so like we build these like facilities, like we have a number of like radiation, like utilizing radioactive energy for all kinds of things, and then we know that they can't last and that there's this like inevitable release of it. There was one point where I was at an event and I was in this room and these people were just doing this presentation. And I happened to be on psychedelics at the time. This was right after Fukushima, and these people, like, I could feel the energy in the room. Like, people were really upset that these people were showing this, but there was they had an image of the planet Earth, stretched out so you could see everything, and it was showing like in a computer model, the different areas being affected over a timeline. So they're moving through time and just showing, since we began fucking with nuclear energy, examples of where there's a fallout occurring in one form or another, either a nuclear blast or an accident, and showing like the degree of it. And it was exponential, practically exponential. So it was just like no matter what you're telling yourself in terms of inevitability here, what are we actually looking at? Like, what is happening beyond what do we feel about what is happening, you know? Because what we feel about what is happening is completely secondary to like the reality of what is taking place. And like what is taking place is a continual increase of us being affected by the nuclear. And so there's this whole weird connection too with like that, I guess, nuclear energy is like one of the very few things that can stop, that can kill fungus. Like fungus grows off of what dies, but fungus doesn't grow from nuclear anything. So that's really Terrence McKenna goes into that a little bit, I guess, but that's really I can see in your comic strip you have a flower on one side, on the left side, and you have some mushrooms growing on the other, you know. It's like this is like as destructive a force as you can possibly imagine. And so and it's the idea of it being a nothing couldn't be more appropriate. I really resonate with that take on the thing, because it's like an invisible enemy, like in that one what's the guy who did the Happening or whatever, the like, what's the guy who did The Village,
M. Night Shyamalan, or
yeah, like that. Yeah, Shyamalama Ding Dong, the one where everyone's from the nothing. It's like Marky Mark and everybody, and it's just like there's nothing there. But like that's totally like what you're dealing with, because it's on the increase, it's on the rise, and you know, it's there in the midst of any appearance. So there's definitely something to be said for that.
Marky Mark, the guy who avoided atomic danger in his Planet of the Apes remake.
Right, there you go.
So I actually want to ask a question about that image in the center where you have the mushroom cloud 9/11 sort of splash page there. I noticed that on the left side image, there's all these sort of monster, sort of dragon type things in the upper left hand corner coming out of the mushroom cloud. And on the right side, not so much. Is there a meaning there?
To an extent, like my understanding of this stuff isn't as good as it should be. Like I'm like doing this book was actually an educational process. So, if I told you how not under control the whole process was, actually you probably wouldn't be surprised, but it was actually a comment that James would often make that, where does that image come from, James? But it's the image of hell, and as in the Scandinavian sense, and, with the serpents and whatnot in the rafters of, what is it, Hell's Palace or something like that, dripping poison and stuff. Like, I don't even know if you got that from, like, that image, like it may have come from like D&D or something. Like it's a sort of a second or third hand.
Yeah, it's like the D&D version of Niflheim, which is like the Norse version of hell. They described the court of hell in there. And
yeah,
in the court of hell, there's like people go there when they die cowardly deaths, and they have to sit in Hell's Hall, there a feast laid out on the table, but they know that all the food is poison, but they can't. They're all starving all the time. If they eat any of the food, they'll die a horrible, hideous death. And the roof drips poison down onto them. In the corner, Nidhogg eats the roots of the world tree, and he's destined to eventually destroy it entirely. And I was thinking that and how GMO foods and nuclear fallout could be said to be in that place right now.
Yeah. What else can I say about that?
I guess I'm asking, it seems like, so you know, that split where you'd start to read from the center to the left. So now the first half is sort of focused on Oppenheimer, and the latter half is sort of focused on Fukushima. Not exactly, but sort of, right? If you know what I mean by that. So I guess my question was, I noticed that the poisonous dragons are on the left side, where you would start to read essentially right to left. But on the left to right page, those are absent. I guess that's what I was asking. Was there a reason why they're not there on one side? Was there a meaning of one being more poisonous, or was there a meaning of just showing a sort of demarcation?
Part of it was just I wanted to stick with the motif of this left-right split. So there's a bit of a, like, you can see that there's obviously a male figure on the right-hand side of the spread with a large phallus, and on the left hand is a woman. So, yeah, that was more of a visual motif thing. So that actually wasn't part of James's writing at all. That was part of the architecture that I came up with and James sort of worked towards. Like we said, we spent a month trying to figure out what both of us were coming up with, because we both had our own ideas about what to do for a sync book piece. So,
can I ask, was the ejaculating male the figure on the right hand side who's standing next to the World Trade Center ejaculating, was that a reference to my 9/11 as an ejaculatory experience?
I don't think so. I actually put that in there. I did the left side first. And the right side, it was more like I needed sort of a, I wanted to have a balance, because I had sort of a bit of a feminine thing going on in the left hand side of the comic. So yeah, I pretty much did that on the fly, and so I I can't say that there was anything conscious in there. So I know that happens a lot. I'm just like, is somebody referring to something I said here? Like, there's this weird give and take with the sync community where you're just kind of like, you don't know if people are communicating with you obliquely or not. So, but it that engages your creativity. So that's.
I thought it was a reference to I Pet Goat 2.
What was that? That animation everybody was talking about a month or two ago. Yeah, I have no idea, man. Like, honestly, I'm just going to tell you, I spent the whole time smoking a lot of pot. So there's not a lot of rational stuff from my end going on there. And I was reading a lot of stuff. I was reading a book called The Hidden World by Carl Ruck. And it's all about, shamanic themes in European fairy tales. So I'm learning about a lot of the stuff as I'm working with the imagery. So there's probably a lot of unintentional gibberish and noise in there.
But that's essential, I think. Yeah. And I think a common thing with any artistic endeavor is that when you kind of allow all that chaos to be burst through with the sort of vulnerable idea that you're trying to get at, is that when you go to try to recreate it from a solid, more solid foundation, when you try to do it again, you ultimately fail, because you try to take out that chaos or that static, and it just sterilizes the whole thing. So what I love about this piece when I look at it is that there's always some new detail that evolves out of what I'm looking at, which feeds back into the ideas expressed in the words, and it's something that I know I want to come back to. And I think part of your process of putting it down on the page, it was probably very essential to that, ultimately.
Well, I think, I guess maybe the the most basic thing I can say about my personal approach to the whole thing was I wanted to somehow use my experience with just spending time with my garden as sort of the structure, I guess. And I asked James to, you know, write some stuff, and I had to take what he had given to me and try to fit that into my idea of the garden, because in the garden you're kind of like, things move on different time scales than they do in, like, for me, who's somebody who spends way too much time on computers and whatnot, it was just really amazing to see what a different world the garden is, and there's all sorts of hidden connections there that you don't notice at first, and things aren't really violent in a garden, but things reach, you're directing things in a garden by planting them, but when they grow and stuff, there's all kinds of things that are going to occur as they occur over time, so you can't really force that garden to do. Gosh, I'm not even sure what I'm trying to say.
Well, isn't it amazing that, you know, people were just absolutely blown away when they first saw the movies of plants growing in sped up time, you know, like The Secret World of Plants.
Yeah.
And because of the technology, you could see just how violent and rhythmic that plants really were. And I think it shocked and scared a lot of people, especially probably 50 years ago when it probably was represented, you know, the top technology, but also unveiling something that had been around us since our inception. And, you know, I think that when I look at this page of the preview, you know, how many days did you spend drawing the finished work?
Oh, gosh. I was very, very sore by the time I was done in actual days drawing it. I did everything in thumbnails first, so I wanted to get the whole thing sort of tied together, but I didn't fill in too many details right away, because I try to leave some room for spontaneity at the actual point of committing the, or rendering the work, I guess, because doing the final pass, I mean, I did the whole thing digitally, so it's really kind of weird. But yeah, at the inking phase, that probably took, I don't know, it's hard to say.
But there's a certain kind of time lapse experience that the reader removed from the process gets to enjoy. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, from idea to finished product might be a week, 2 weeks, or a month, but then the reader gets the luxury of taking it all in within the span of, well, especially in a comic medium, I mean, initially just scanning the landscape of it, you get to see maybe a month's worth of work in 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And so when I look at the work that you produced, I mean, it just explodes. I mean, it's just shimmering. There's a certain energy that is just kind of erupting off the page. And it's impressive. But then when you have the time to actually focus in on certain specific points, you get to sort of the calmer underlying nature of the actual work that was involved, you know, the late nights and the frustrated hurdles and the blocks that you have to fight through. I don't think any other medium quite captures it like the comic medium. So the fact that you were working in a garden throughout this and using that as sort of like a incubation space or a meditational space just seems to fit perfectly.
Yeah, there's certain insights that I've had just from having a relationship with, I mean, I call it a garden, but it's way more than that. There's like, oh my gosh, soil science is really amazing to me. The hidden connections underneath the soil. Like, there's so much life under there. Fungally speaking, microbially speaking, like, there's so much in there. I mean, gosh, wow, I just keep fucking gapping out. This is gonna sound like the worst.
Oh no, it's fine.
Ever.
Yeah, don't sweat it. Fine. Don't sweat it. All right, I have. If I may, I want to just take it to the art for a minute because as Bill was saying, all this sort of attention to detail. There's a few things. This one is just a sort of personal question that for myself that was kind of making me crazy. There's one panel when you're talking about the Fukushima radiation. And there's an arm reaching out for a gallon or a half gallon of milk. And that arm, I was like, I've seen that arm before. Is that the kid from Where the Wild Things Are?
No. I think I was actually trying to render a woman's arm.
That was I thought of, too, was Where the Wild Things Are when I saw the right above there when it's like, where you have, the guy from The NeverEnding Story.
Yeah, exactly. So you have NeverEnding Story, and then below it, there's this arm, and the, like, I guess sleeve looks, you know, the kid from Where the Wild Things Are? He has almost that sort of, like, pajamas with, like, scales on it?
Yeah.
Right, but in fucking NeverEnding Story, he's wearing the Nothing Wolf, right? Like, he's wearing it as a garment, and he looks like he's looking out from the cave at the end where he says this comment. Like, he's taking on the role of the Nothing or something. It's like, am I reading into that correctly or what? Like, where he says, Fantastica is the world of human fantasies, there are no boundaries. The Nothing Wolf says that, right? That's like the statement of the Nothing Wolf.
Yeah.
But he's wearing a wolf, like, so, and it looks like he's in the cave, so.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. The best way I can explain that is I was reading that Carl Ruck book, and it's a series of essays on basically, like, he talks a lot about Amanita muscaria but the essay that I was reading at the time was mostly about werewolves. And just the taking on of just the way they would, these weird, I don't even know what, I don't know this stuff, but from what I'm gathering, the werewolf thing comes up a lot when you start looking into, like, the traditions of Amanita muscaria, like, dressing up in the skins of, like, a bear or a wolf or whatever, and using the substances, whatever they are specifically. It just, in my head, as soon as I saw that scene in The NeverEnding Story, and when I read The NeverEnding Story earlier this year, it was even more apparent to me that there was something really weird about Gmork. Like, I interpreted him as, like, some sort of, like a CIA agent. Like, that's the best way I can put it. Mm-hmm. So... I mean, even in the NeverEnding Story, the book, they don't mention the name of this ruined city in the movie where he finds Gmork, but it's called Spook City, and just everything.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, and of course, the CIA agent, the CIA agent would go in to topple a government or something like that. That's why you'd have the ruined city.
Yeah,
Michael End was German, right? So it's originally written in German, and so I love the second half of the NeverEnding Story. That's, like, so fucking good. The whole thing with the Ouroboros thing at the end, and the way that they reconcile it, and, like, the movie never shows why it literally is a NeverEnding Story, and, like, that whole, like, final stretch of the book is just absolutely incredible. Okay, I wanted to ask you, so I was just looking at your blog or your website, you have this one comic, and you're just talking about your garden, and I see this, like, thing with this kid in the theater, and it's like, this dog is like, get back to your garden, snake. And so I had a recent experience dealing with, like, serpents And just basically, I had all of these realizations, and I went to my rabbi and kind of ran them by him, and he was very affirming in his response to it, which was basically, this is somewhat complex, but in terms of looking at the tree of life as a template for like the substratum of our perceptions, and considering the lightning bolt that runs down its center in terms of like how it expresses itself from the most etheric to the most dense, and how that lightning strike is also related to a serpent. And then the word for serpent in Hebrew, nechesh, has the value of 358, which is the third, fourth, and fifth numbers of the Fibonacci sequence, and how like relating the snake to the Fibonacci, and then considering this idea that you have this thing that like this force that runs down these pathways, but then looks when it gets to the most dense to return, and the fact that it can't return, and how there's this repeated symbolism of the snake, where the like the snake is held under the foot of Eve, actually. And then you'll see more modern art with the Virgin Mary, where she's got her foot on the snake, and this idea that the snake is trying to bite her ankle, and she's crushing the head of the snake. But this notion that the most sacred, that once it reaches the most dense level and it tries to return, it can never actually get back and ends up destroying itself, which is where you have this idea of the Ouroboros, right? Which I might not be pronouncing correctly, Ouroboros or whatever. But anyways, this like self-destructive force being serpentine in nature, and then considering like what happens when you take ayahuasca, which a lot of people look at as a serpentine energy. I don't necessarily feel that way. I feel more like it's just the plant medicine is able to make a break in the inertia of this process that's like basically these lines of force that are serpentine in nature have like embedded themselves in the material. And it's actually when you put in something to that disrupts that their grip, that they actually recoil. And that's why it appears as an exorcism, is because they are like lines of tension almost that are holding together the perceptual reality. And so like when they recoil back, they like almost can feel kind of violent because they're trying to maintain their structure. But in allowing them to recoil, the thing itself becomes more malleable. And so you can kind of like recognize how it can retake form. And so I was considering the whole nuclear thing from this angle of like when you, it's like an accelerator button on the destructive side of it, but in doing that it ends up like being able to reflect upon itself in ways that it otherwise wouldn't be able to. And that, like, I mean, do you know about like the bears at the Chernobyl site, like that there's these bears that are just like existing there and apparently unaffected and they don't know why or anything? Have you heard about that?
No, James, have you heard anything about that, James? If James is even there.
No, I'm here.
Radioactive bears at Chernobyl?
Yeah, they've like adapt or whatever, and are like, that there is a certain amount of bears that are actually in that, around that site, that just do their thing, and it's really fucking weird. So I've heard.
Some of the fallout from Chernobyl didn't go in a like predictable circle. It roamed all over the place. Like, right. Some places right next to it were more dangerous than like places in Scotland, because there was like a roaming cloud that went around and rained fallout.
Well, they covered it in cement, right?
Like, yeah.
Zero, they just... They're like, oh, well, we'll just fucking cover this whole area in cement, as if that would, I mean, I don't know how that helped or whatever, but...
Let's stop fresh fallout from coming out.
Right. Huh. Well, yeah, very strange.
And it was, you know, last year there were trees that were irradiated and they caught fire in a big forest fire, so the smoke from those trees went up to the... Do the jet streams, like the firefighters had to take countermeasures to fight the fire, like radiation precautions, or whatever the hell they did.
There's a similar element in your comic, the Sync Book comic, that I mean, so obviously these are all interrelated ideas to begin with, but there's a similar one
where you mention the Indian territories that are blank spots on a map, this idea of this sort of dead zone or no man's land, in the same way we might see with like a Chernobyl of like, okay, this, we just take this area off the map, that's gone now, it's been consumed by the nothing. What's that?
The forbidden zone.
Yeah, exactly. There's something really interesting, I don't know if this was intentional, but just the way just looking at it, there is the way you draw the map, and you show, here's a map with an Indian reserve that just has this sort of cross-hatched, it's almost like a square with a corner taken out. So it's this almost like fat L shape with cross-hatching, and that's your Indian reserve. And it's like this dead spot on the map. And then if you look at the last page where you see the army guy and you see his outfit and the way that you drew the camouflage, camouflage is basically represented the same way, of this sort of geometric shape with the cross hatching, and it's just really interesting to me that basically would being the army man is almost like notches on a belt collecting all these dead zones that he's creating.
Oh, scary.
Wow, man. See, I'm learning a lot about my comic just by talking to you guys. yeah, that's probably just one of those things that happens. Because you have to sort of retrench yourself to certain stylistic ways of rendering to keep the style relatively the same throughout the comic. And I didn't even treat this as a comic, so go ahead.
Why is that soldier wearing digitized camel print in his remote trailer where he's flying that drone?
I don't know. I went looking for images of people in drone control centers, and they were dressed in all manner of different things. And I'm pretty sure that one of them was dressed in the digital camo. Yeah. So that's why I went with that.
Well, just protocol. He's dressed in it, but it could be the manifestation of the nothing.
But yeah, that particular panel with the map. That's actually while I was researching the maps of that region of Nevada, I realized that like there's this huge, huge blanked out area that you guys are probably familiar with there in Nye County, Nevada, with all the test range and Area 51, I think, and just all that stuff north of Las Vegas. And there's this tiny little official Indian territory left over. I'm just like, wow, that's
where they do Burning Man. Very close by on the same playa they did crazy nuclear testing. And so I always find that interesting when I go out there, that there's like this kind of looming energetic from that, you know. And they say, oh, it's okay now, but it's like, wow, that's here. And next to, like, kitty corner to that, with the guy with the hole in his face, and it says, don't be so irrational, is he looking into a laptop that's got an upside-down apple that turns into a mushroom, suggesting that the fruit of life is indeed a mushroom? And then you have that parallel to the mushroom cloud?
We wrote that panel, but without any details. It was just supposed to be a dude who can't stop himself from commenting on the internet, something I suffer from myself. And the mushroom came at the very end, because I knew I wanted to have him in a dark room in front of a laptop, but I was just
Is the mushroom supposed to be an upside-down apple?
No.
Oh, okay. That's what
I was reading this Carl Ruck book, and, you know, he's constantly sliding between, like, oh, well, there's the mushroom is actually the apple, and the apple is actually this, and like the weird way that all the imagery is mixed up. I mean, you're dealing with hundreds of years of, I don't even know what to call it. Like the book I was reading, it's basically looking at the so-called fairy tale layer, which mostly seems to be commissioned pieces by people with money, whether they're works of art, private paintings, writings, for like, it's basically, to me, it sounded like branding, but what they were, what it's based on is it definitely some sort of folklore tradition behind that. And that's the shamanic themes. So it's in that weird layer, the fairy tale layer, that it seems that there's all this, they're like, everybody's hiding obvious. I mean, they're supposed to be hiding stuff in all of this imagery, but it's pretty obvious if you're actually aware of where that comes from. And I'm just starting to learn this stuff. So you guys are probably more hip to a lot of this stuff than I am. So it was just amazing to see that this stuff keeps working as I apply myself to it. So I don't know if it's just because I've found my inroad into this stuff, but like becoming creatively involved with it was really important because it engaged my interest and suddenly it, you know, personalized this stuff on a level that wasn't there before. So I don't know. It's a very difficult thing to talk about and I keep wandering. So oh,
you're great. Wow. Yeah. You know what? This is what happens when you put anything creative out there and people analyze it, is that they'll end up telling you things that you yourself hadn't considered or realized, to use the term, about your own creation. Like, mm-hmm. there's actually a thing, I think in the Midrash or something, of somebody going, somebody basically looking at the Zohar and asking Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, about it. And he's like, wow, I didn't think of that. And they're like, you know, that's like, you didn't have to, you know, like, that was the point. Like, you presented the thing, and then because it came from this place, all this stuff is inherent within it. You know, it's like any Kubrick film, you know, you can go in and find all these things, and I'm sure we're not intentional, but they're archetypal, and so you can't help but read into it further, which doesn't, you know, it's not the point whether or not the artist intended it, you know.
Isn't that like Lynch? I mean, isn't Lynch the premier example of that nowadays? And just how much fun he must have whenever in the last 15 years just reading what people see reflected in his own work.
Yeah.
And never giving an inch, never giving a single inch as to what's intended, and probably knowing, much like this work here, is that, you know, stuff is going to creep into it. I mean, I think the whole character of Bob in Twin Peaks is like the perfect example of that, and how he saw his face reflected in that mirror on accident and then just incorporated it into the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as that's how he tells the tale, sure. I tend to believe him, but it's a very brave way of making art. It definitely throws away formula. I mean, maybe it's anti-formula. I'm sure you can force it and it can come off as obviously trying too hard. But I'm just so glad that... And I think I found that myself in the piece that I put in the Sync book as well, in that being able to step away from it and reorient myself to what I put in there is magical in itself, because I tend to like it more and more every day. Exactly the opposite of what I expected. So I'm hoping you're feeling the exact same thing. It sounds like you are.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking to. Well, I was just like, while you guys are talking, I was tripping out on the same thing I was tripping out on last week, which is I just put up a link a minute ago to this piece of artwork that a collage work that I did that I didn't mean to include. I didn't mean to make the whole thing into this giant mushroom cloud. And I was just totally like tripped out when I finished it. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, I made a mushroom cloud. Like, very, very strange. Like, it was. And then I can see all the elements are there. I have mushrooms and mushroom clouds within the piece. But I didn't intend for the whole thing to be a giant mushroom cloud, which it totally is. And so, like, there's that phenomenon of being ahead of oneself. So I was identifying with what you were saying, so it came out automatically.
Well, ideally, how big would you like that image, if it were to be presented, let's say, not on a computer, Would you like to keep it a modest size dimension, or because in my mind I see that blown up almost 10 feet tall, you know?
Yeah. Are you talking? Well, who are you talking to?
I guess both. Both, yeah. As far as graphically, like I keep seeing that preview image of Justin and Jason James's work. I keep seeing that as a poster. You know what I mean? Maybe about 6 feet in length. You know, it just blown up. It's just such an absorbing image, and I reflect back upon your work too, David. Is that I would love to see those images. Just in a different scale. I'm not saying they would improve upon them, but
love to have a print of this artwork that you did. I would definitely hang this shit on my wall. It's epic.
Awesome. Well, that was I can let you in on a little secret. I didn't really approach it as a comic. It's partly why I really wanted James on it, because the dude knows how to pace a comic. Knows how to write a comic, knows how panels and stuff work, but I approached it from it just basically being one giant wide panel. And like I said, I was reading this Carl Rook book at the time, and they were talking a lot about artists and whatnot who would be commissioned to do these weird murals and stuff that were, you know, semi-pornographic and had all kinds of weird stuff in there that they wouldn't want to share with polite society and whatnot. So, I would have worked on it as just one large piece if I could have, but just technical reasons, I had to split it up into a few sections. But yeah, I tried to keep the overall view there all of the time while working on the details as well. So, constantly shuttling back and forth, yeah.
Any influence of R. Crumb on your style?
People always say that. I think it's probably partly because it's an easy thing to get into, just the hatching and stuff.
Rick Griffin more than R. Crumb, probably. You guys know Rick Griffin?
Oh, is he... Oh, who is that? You have to refresh my memory.
He's actually hands down my favorite artist, but he basically, like, all this, the 60s style flyers that went out that were super psychedelic, he pretty much like coined all of that. Like, yeah, just absolutely fucking incredible. He basically very similar to R. Crumb, but more in a way more mystical, insightful tip, and less on the purely like sexual depraved end of things. Which actually, if you look at what R. Crumb is doing now, he just did the Book of Genesis. You know, he's really like refined his approach to the whole thing, which is incredible. But yeah, Rick Griffin, highly, highly recommend. You look the stuff up, you'll immediately like recognize it, like eyes with wings and whatnot, like very.
Yeah, I'm looking at his website now. It looks like it's just wow.
He died in a motorcycle accident, actually, quite a while ago. But it's weird. I was working at a record store, and this guy was in there, and I made a comment about a record cover, and he's like, "My dad did that," and I was like, "Fuck you, dude! Your dad didn't do that." And he was like, "No, my dad's name was Rick Griffin. He died in a motorcycle accident. That's his artwork." Yeah. So this is his son, you know, and I see him all the time still, you know. He works at a bagelry, you know, and like he worked next door to me, actually. And so I'm like, wow. But he's actually organizing right now to make a documentary about his father's life. Or this other guy is actually doing it, and he's helping, you know, getting that moving. So they're doing fundraising and stuff to make that happen. Yeah, he did that cover. And I don't know how you pronounce that, but yeah.
Yeah, well, it is definitely a small world. I keep learning that lesson, and that's just as far as comics go. Like, I'm from a small Canadian town, but I can name off a few people. There's a dude named James Lloyd that came out of Vernon. Like, there's only like 35,000 people in this town. We're not it's kind of hard to explain the interior of the Okanagan. There's no major big cities here. So the coast of Vancouver is really the big center. But yeah, James Lloyd, he pencils, he's been penciling for, was it Bongo Comics for years? He's like been the official, one of the official dudes behind Futurama for years. And that's just like, and there's another girl from this area named Camilla DeErico from a town called Lumbee, about 20-30 minutes from here. And she's into the whole pop surrealism thing. Yeah, and that's the vector there is definitely Vancouver. And because there's a, it's Hollywood North there, so it's kind of a slightly different scene there. So, but there's also, you know, a lot of underground people like,
Colin Upton,
yeah, he's the main one. Very interesting dude. And he doesn't do any commercial work at all. All he does is mini comics. These little, you know, go into some of the little places in Vancouver and there's just Colin Upton comics everywhere. And he's been doing this for 20-30 years. And he's just like, there's no like separation between him and his comics. It's kind of weird, but it's not iconic in the way that like R. Crumb is. It's just like, I know it's kind of hard to explain. So like R. Crumb at this point, it's like, I mean, just the fact that I get that so often with the R. Crumb thing, I think that's just because it's almost like a packaged style at this point. I mean,
which is ridiculous in a way, because all it is that he took that classic style that was already existent in cartoon and just like, you know, psychedelicized it and made the subject matter more challenging for some people, and just really just went to the core of issues, like very like, you know, a lot of his stuff is very Freudian, but then with the psychedelic edge. But it's just people just relate it because that's become the, like, I don't know, like the association. So whatever, you know, that's the way it goes. He popularized something too.
Yeah.
But I mean, he wasn't the only one working on that is the thing. It's just that he got more attention, which is fine. He was very talented. But at the same time, it's like there's a fucking huge community involved with Zap. Like Rick Griffin contributed to Zap Comics at the same time R. Crumb did. But, you know, the name isn't quite as familiar, even though it should be, you know. So whatever, you know. That's the way it goes.
Yep. Popular perception of, I mean, there's, I mean, have you guys ever heard of, was it, I think it's called Round Level Comics or something like that? Apparently there was this, Dave Sim wrote some articles on this, Dave Sim, the creator and author of Cerebus. And it's a Canadian comic. I don't know if, are you guys familiar with that at all?
Mm-hmm. I learned of Cerebus from Alan, actually. And it's overwhelming. I definitely have that on a list of, like, down the road, I definitely want to dive into that entire archive because it's pretty mind-blowing.
Okay. I just wanted to see who knew who Dave Sim was and whatnot. So he has a... Cerebus wrapped up, there's 300 issues, wrapped up in, what was it, 2004 or 2005, and there was a magazine that came out, sort of a, it was called Following Cerebus. I'm not sure if it's still published, but weirdly it was published by the same people that did a, Twin Peaks. It was a Twin Peaks magazine where they would do a lot of analysis and whatnot, breakdown of Twin Peaks. I've never read any of those, but I just wanted to say that. The ground level thing. So in one of his articles, he was talking about this whole historical thing that I had never heard of before, where in the late 70s and early 80s, there was sort of, I don't know if he was just trying to make a distinction or if people actually used the term or not, but he called it, I think it was ground level comics as opposed to underground comics. And I think they were called ground level comics because they would be put in on the shelves at ground level. And I guess these were more comics that weren't really like absolutely, well, I mean, you know, some of the places that R. Crumb and the so-called underground artists would go were just like, you wouldn't find those on your average shelf in the late 70s or early 80s in your local comic shop. So I guess it was sort of, to me, it was interesting to find out that there was this gap that people actually were thinking about bridging there, because they wanted to do, I can't even think of any examples. I guess Howard the Duck would be, I think, one of those examples where it's sort of, a, I don't know, though making it too simple a situation. Example. It's like, it's where the so-called mainstream meets the underground. So there's a lot of historical things that I'm still learning. And anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there for some reason.
The Cerebus stuff looks to be like completely Frazetta inspired, even though I see like an initial, I recognize the characters from it. I've definitely seen this before. But like just looking it up, I can immediately see like one obviously like a almost like spoofy kind of version on a Frank Frazetta that's really familiar. But then looking at the rest of it, it's like, it's definitely like taking Frazetta and almost like just playing with that kind of style and bringing it to another level.
Yeah, Cerebus started out as a sword and sorcery parody comic, I guess. And from what I understand, I think it was within the first dozen issues of that Dave went kind of mad. I guess he was smoking a lot of pot and doing LSD, and he started talking to his characters as if they were in the room with him. And his girlfriend at the time and his mother, I guess, had him committed for about a week or two. But it was also during that period where he had what he calls the white light experience. And this is where apparently, this is almost mythological at this point, at least from my weird perspective, because I'm really focused on, or was really focused on Cerebus during the 90s and the early noughties. But he had the white light experience, and he conceived the whole Cerebus thing apparently just like that. So, and it became something else. So he took the Cerebus comic that he was already doing and sort of gave it an hook. Apparently he had this end game planned for the longest time, but there were a lot of things that came up in his life. Like when he turned 40, apparently he read the Bible for the first time and decided that was for him. So it was, I don't know. Dave Sim's a whole big thing.
Mm-hmm. I had actually reached out to one of his representatives because Dave Sim wrote this essay about synchronicity. And apparently he was talking about how him and Bill Sienkiewicz used to talk about synchronicity all the time. And Bill is probably my favorite comic artist of all time. I'd be hard-pressed to think of somebody better than Bill Sienkiewicz. And he wrote this essay about him and Bill talking about synchronicity all the time and how it was a major factor in their artwork. And I've spoken to a representative, Dave Sim, to try and get him to either contribute that essay or something else for the Sync Book series.
Cool.
Was that successful at all? I don't know if I should be asking about, like, I have no idea who actually wound up on the lineup for the Sync Book 2, but...
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I spoke to him. He asked me to fax him some information, which I did, and then I didn't hear back, and then I should have followed up with it, but I quickly ended up with more than 26 authors already for the book. So I had to split the book into two parts anyway. So we're going to do a third volume. So I figured I'd follow up with them for part three, but I didn't want to be holding off trying to work things out with Dave Sim and then, telling other people to, hey, it was just awkward enough as it was trying to figure out once I realized I had more than 26 authors. I didn't want to be trying to push people into the third volume, and I ended up unfortunately having to do that. There's a few people who got pushed into the third book, but
I wasn't trying to put a lot of energy into that. I wanted to focus on the people who had already, sort of followed through and actually were giving me stuff. So I do plan on reaching back out to them for the third one when I have, more time to do it.